Good morning. I welcome you all to the Human Services Finance and Policy Committee. I call the committee to order. We have a quorum present. Chair Schumacher, do you want to move the approval of minutes?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to move the minutes from March 25th, 2025.
Chair Schumacher moves the approval of minutes for March 25th, 2025. Discussions? Hearing none. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The motion prevails, and the minutes for March 25th, 2025 are now approved. Members, we've got a lengthy agenda, and the first bill before us today is House File 2060. Representative Nadeau, I will move that House File 2060 be laid over for possible inclusion in future omnibus bill, and I see you've got an A1 author's amendment. So I move A1 amendment to put the bill in the shape the author wants. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Hearing none. Motion prevails. You have the bill before us as amended. Please proceed with the introduction of the bill.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members. Today we're here to talk about House File 2060, which is the supported decision-making bill. Supported decision-making is an approach to decision-making for adults with intellectual or developmental disabilities or other cognitive impairments that provides them the support that they need to be the ultimate decision-makers in matters concerning their own lives. With supported decision-making, decision-makers are assisted by one or more people of their choosing in understanding options, implications, and consequences of a decision, and if necessary, in communicating and interpreting their preferences to others as an alternative to the more restrictive forms of decision-making, including guardianship and conservatorship. Unlike guardianship, which often strips individuals of the majority of their individual rights, supported decision-making allows individuals to retain their legal and civil rights and make their own informed decisions. In 2023, the legislature authorized DHS to award grants to organizations for supported decision-making services as an alternative to guardianship. The first report has been delivered to the legislature, and while supported decision-making is a relatively new practice, it's clear that grantees are raising awareness with partners, individuals are utilizing the alternative and satisfied with the approach, and unnecessary guardianships are being avoided. House 2060 transfers the unexpended appropriation from last year to the next biennium and adds $2 million to the current biennium to continue this important alternative to guardianship. And with that, I would like to turn it over to my perfect testifiers.
Good morning. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning. Good morning. Before I begin reading my testimony, I would just like to take this opportunity to thank Chair Knorr and Chair Schumacher and the rest of the committee for allowing me to speak on behalf of this very important bill that is very important to my life. My name is Rochelle Laumer, and I am a constituent from St. Paul, Minnesota. In my life as a self-advocate, I wear many hats, one of them being a co-facilitator for a supported decision-making course. This course is a part of the Advocating Change Together, or ACT, works funded by the Supported Decision-Making Grant that my coworker Betty and I offer to individuals with disabilities who attend day programs at a company called RISE in Crystal, Minnesota. Through this program, I have witnessed the positive impact and growth it has had on our participants, starting from when they first walk into their first class to when they graduate from the program. Okay, this is where we're gonna have a little fun. Let's play a little scenario game really quick. Say that you are the age you are at right now, with all your genders and, you know, if you're married or whatever, and let's just say that you're living in a group home, okay? How would you feel if there was someone that you don't know, or maybe you do know, but you don't want to make certain decisions for you? How would you feel if you were told if you could or could not have a phone, and if you could have a phone, how would you feel if that phone was taken away from you at a certain point at night where you didn't have access to it and it was locked away in a room? Or how would you feel if you were told when to go to bed, when to take a shower, or more important decisions like whether to get married or to go to college? These are just some of the examples that some of our participants have complained about, that they don't have the options or the decision that they can make themselves. It's made for them. Now, try to imagine how that would feel if that were you. These participants have expressed this, and and this is their life, so that shouldn't they have a say in what they should do with their life and not someone else? I believe that this program could help empower and give some of the participants their power back that they may have felt that they have lost due to all these changes being made for them. And if we extend this program, I believe that we could reach more people, not just in Crystal, not just in Big Lake, which is also where we did another class as well, but just not to both of those, but all over Minnesota, for all the participants to feel as empowered and self-determined as these participants do. In order to make this possible, I request that the committee support House File 2060 so that we can continue the important work of the Supported Decision-Making Grant. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ms. Loma. To the next testifier, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Chairs and members, my name is Hannah Dietrich, and I'm the Department Administrator at Hennepin County Adult Representation Services. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before the committee today in support of House File 2060. ARS is a Hennepin County department that provides independent legal representation, advocacy, and support to clients experiencing poverty in civil matters where they are entitled to an attorney. This includes representing persons at risk of or subject to a guardianship. Our role is singularly to advocate to preserve our clients' rights and dignity. In July of last year, ARS was awarded $770,000 from the state of Minnesota to provide supported decision-making services and advance supported decision-making program objectives. As you've heard, supported decision-making protects individuals' rights to make decisions when they can do so and ensures they have support with making decisions when they request or need this help. This support can come from an identified family member, a friend, an advocate, or other trusted person of their choosing. Whereas guardianship is restrictive, burdensome, and expensive, supported decision-making supports individuals' rights and autonomy and is both efficient and cost-effective. This is true not only for the individual, but also family members and loved ones, the courts, and service providers, such as hospitals, care facilities, and education-based transitions programs. I'd like to highlight some of the work we've been able to do thus far with the funding. Through this funding, we've been able to create a partnership with Hennepin County Medical Center to work with low-income, willing and able patients to establish a healthcare directive and identify a healthcare agent. Prior to this partnership, hospital social workers and medical providers would petition the courts to appoint a guardian to make medical decisions for patients whose decision-making ability was in question. This is a process that could take 2 to 3 months with a patient unable to leave the hospital and potentially miss out on treatment options while waiting for a surrogate decision maker. With this partnership, however, we can connect patients with a healthcare agent in 2 to 7 days at no cost to the individual or the hospital. This funding has also allowed us to build relationships with organizations and trusted transitions program professionals to provide education about supported decision making to families whose children have individual education plans. The language in IEP centers on guardianship, with little to no acknowledgement of alternatives or awareness that decision making is a skill that can be fostered and supported. For many families, a guardianship for their child is neither necessary nor ideal, as it takes away a child's civil liberties, it subjects parents to court supervision for as long as the guardianship is open, and it stalls skill development that could increase one's autonomy and inclusion in their community. Further, for many low-income families, guardianship is perceived as the only financial option because the court will pay a private attorney's fee for guardianship, but not alternatives such as supported decision-making. As part of our outreach efforts with this funding, we have received and taken in clients and referrals from private attorneys in the community to help low-income families obtain legal advice and explore no-cost alternatives to guardianship. One of our goals with this funding has also been to increase accessibility of the language and information about supported decision making. We're working with an organization to translate information about supported decision making into multiple languages. House File 2060 ensures that we can continue to advance the goals of this funding and advocate for the protection of individuals' rights and autonomy in efficient and cost-effective ways. Our objectives are to build relationships, educate trusted professionals, and empower individuals like Rochelle. For these reasons, I respectfully request that you support the extension of this funding. Thank you for the opportunity to talk today about the need for this important legislation.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Do we have anyone else in the public who wants to testify on this bill? Seeing none, members discussion, Representative Hicks.
I love supportive decision making. Thank you so much for bringing this. I personally believe that it is a way that we can really instill autonomy and fight back against ableism, because if we assume that people can't, they won't. And if we empower them to, they will. So thank you so much for this bill.
Any member discussions? Seeing none, it's a good bill. Representative Rendell, your closing remarks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members. This is a great example of how state resources are leveraged at the local level to create new innovative programs, and in this case, one that treats people with dignity, reduces unnecessary costly guardianships, and empowers people living in communities. So thank you, and I hope we can get this one through.
Thank you so much. The next bill before us will be House File. Just to confirm, I renew my motion that House File 2060 is laid over. The House File 2060 is laid over. The next bill before us is House File 2209. Chair Beard, as you're coming up, I will move that House File 2299 be laid over for possible inclusion in a future omnibus bill. And I see you've got an A1 author's amendment. Members, I move A1 author's amendment on behalf of Chair Bierman. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. To your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members, for hearing this bill today. There are two small items in here that will make a huge difference to our home care providers who serve medically complex kids. The first piece delays a rate change that is set to go into effect in July of this year that is unworkable for our specialty enteral nutrition formula providers. The July 1 rate works for standard formula, but not specialty formula. Pediatric Home Service is the only provider in Minnesota serving medically complex kids with this kind of specialized nutrition care. And this will give them more time to work with manufacturers and the department on a reimbursement rate that doesn't give them a massive cut. It's important to note that this rate delay is at no cost. The second piece in the bill provides some administrative relief to both providers and the department for reimbursements for three very high volume products like feeding tubes and accessories and tracheostomy tubes. This proposal will have the department hard code a rate to save thousands of pieces of paper and hours of staff time. This is an easy fix and a simple thing we can do to help make care coordination easier for the families and kids who need these products to stay alive and thrive. One final note, members, everything before Subdivision 13 is just a recodification that Senate Council drafted to better organize this section after years of many changes. The actual changes we are looking at today are Subdivisions 13, 14, and 15 at the very end. Mr. Chair, I'd like to turn it over to Cameo Zender to give you some more background and to get into the details, please.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Cameo Zender, and I'm with Pediatric Home Service. As Representative Bierman describes, this bill serves two purposes. First, it maintains the current payment rates for enteral nutrition products ensuring that medically complex children continue to have access to their most specialized products. Second, it streamlines billing processes for other specialized medical supplies, saving time for both providers and the state. Beginning with enteral nutrition, in 2023, we passed a rate methodology that takes into consideration the higher clinical touch, administrative requirements, and delivery challenges associated with the enteral nutrition product category. However, that methodology has explicit claims volume and provider participation requirements that are not satisfied with these most specialized products that are uniquely ordered for pediatrics. As a stopgap measure, we passed 2 one-year extensions to maintain those previous rates. This bill creates a 2-year extension during which time we are committed to developing a similar payment methodology that is tailored for pediatric enteral nutrition. Moving to the second purpose, to streamline billing processes, our kids are super special, and so too are many of the medical supplies they require. A few additional examples of products that are common to this population but not common among the broader Medicaid population include low-profile G-tubes or feeding tubes, feeding accessory sets, and specialized pediatric tracheostomy tubes. Claims for these products are manually processed, meaning that the provider submits the claim and then must separately fax, yes, I said fax, a pricing attachment from the manufacturer. The department then must match the claim with the fax, calculate a rate, and then push it through for payment. This sounds clunky, but it may not sound overly burdensome until we talk about it in numbers. PHS alone submits 2,000 of these pricing attachments every month. And for every single one that we fax, the department must also process. The case for efficiency is compelling. If we hard code the 25 most common products in these three categories just one time per year, we'll be able to automate the claims processing for these products, equating to 20,000 claims each year. That's an 833-fold in efficiency gain. I ask for your consideration for House File 2299 so we can get back to what's most important, which is caring for our kids, and maybe unplug some of those fax machines. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Do we have anyone in the public who wants to testify on this bill? Seeing none, members' discussion? Chair Bierman, I think you've got a good bill that there's no conversation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members. This bill will improve delivery efficiency and care for children with complex conditions, and we appreciate your help. Thank you.
Thank you so much. House File 2299, as amended, is laid over. The next bill before us is House File 2758. Chair Fisher.
Thank you, Chair Noor. I'd like to move to lay House File 2758 over for possible inclusion in a future omnibus bill.
Please introduce a bill and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Noor and committee for the opportunity to present House File 2758. This bill does not make any statutory changes. What it does is it reformulates and changes around certain requirements in Statute 256B.0622. To separate out a couple of different services that are being provided right now. The current statute has two services combined together. One is intensive residential services. The other one is the Assertive Community Treatment Program, also known as ACT. The ACT program is more of a is a program where we provide services that are not in a residential setting. And as I mentioned with the intensive residential, that is a residential setting. And so because we've got these two mixed together, there have been times when we have a lot of confusion and people are kind of going, well, which statute applies, which part applies to which program? And so what this does is it's just taking those two and breaking them out into separate statutes, but it has the same language being used that's appropriate for the Act in the Act section and the information for the intensive residential services grouped together in their own section to help provide greater clarity going forward.
Thank you, Chair Fisher. Do we have anyone in the public who wants to testify on this bill? Seeing none, members' discussion. To your closing remarks, Chairperson.
Thank you, Chair Noor. I think this is a really good bill. I would ask for your support. And with that, I renew my motion to have House File 2758 laid over.
House File 2758 is laid over. So the next bill we have on our calendar is House File 1861. Representative Agbaje, welcome to the committee. I will move that House File 1861 be referred to Public Safety, Policy and Finance. Please introduce your bill and proceed.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. So this bill builds, House File 1861 builds on a law that was passed in 2023 that made connecting people who were incarcerated better connected to their families, particularly via the telephone, and they made those phone calls free. That law ensures that incarcerated people have the ability to call their families at no cost to them or their own families. And we did this because most of the burden of predatory call rates fall on incarcerated people or their families, particularly if they come from, you know, a single-family home or single-parent family home or something like that. So that was creating another barrier from keeping families together despite a person's sentence. The bill before us today expands the ability to connect to include all forms of communication like email and video calls. And it even covers people who are confined civilly by the state, like people in the MSOP program. What we know from research is that people who are able to connect with their families and their support systems are less likely to go back to prison than those who are cut off. By making phone calls free, we eliminated a significant cost to incarcerated persons and their families and fostered connections. In the fiscal note, you'll see that the Department of Corrections is projecting a cost of $2.6 million this next biennium and $3.3 million in the tails. But the department is also aware of up to $900,000 or more in cost savings, with the cost of phone calls now capped by the federal government, which should reduce the Department of Corrections phone call cost by 40%. And so as the state bill, or as the state, the bill would also direct the department to report their efforts at negotiating better prices for other forms of communication as well to ensure more cost savings. By finishing what we started in 2023, we can ensure that more families can stay together, children can maintain relationships with their parents, and once released, formerly incarcerated people have a better chance at being successful on the outside. And by providing these same resources to those who are civilly confined, we can see similar positive results with rehabilitation if people in treatment feel less isolated from the outside world. I believe I have some testifiers with me today who can discuss more about the benefits of the free cost of communication program for incarcerated persons and how advancing this will continue to support initiatives for people who are both criminally and civilly confined. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Do you have testifiers today?
I thought there was one in person and one online.
We have someone via Zoom. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Hello, good morning, everyone. My name is Antonia Jeffrey, and I'm the Director of Policy Campaigns and Government Affairs at Worth Rises, a national nonprofit dedicated to ending the exploitation of people impacted by incarceration. And I'm here in strong support of HF 1861 today. Minnesota made significant strides in 2023 by making phone calls free for incarcerated people and their loved ones. HF 1861 builds on that success by extending free communications to include video calls and electronic messaging, ensuring that incarcerated individuals can maintain meaningful connections with families. Thank you for taking the time to hear this testimony regarding this legislation, and thank you to Rep. Abaji for sponsoring this bill. I hope that you will take special note of the powerful stories shared by those directly impacted by incarceration and the burdens imposed by the exorbitant cost of prison communication. I will instead focus my testimony on the policy arguments and fiscal considerations that support it. Worth Rises has helped jurisdictions across the country pass similar policies to provide free communication for incarcerated people and their support networks. We led the first state campaign in Connecticut and additional state campaigns in California, Colorado, Massachusetts, and here in Minnesota. We also led or supported successful local campaigns in New York City, San Francisco, San Diego, Los Angeles and Miami. Accordingly, we know what it takes to implement this policy and are committed to helping Minnesota take the next step in making communications free. Based on our analysis, we project that expanding free communications to include video calls and electronic messaging would cost the state as little as roughly $750,000 annually. We base our estimates on known rates charged by leading vendors across the country, which in many cases are much lower than the rates charged in Minnesota and usage rates in jurisdictions with free communications. Notably, in Minnesota, video calls are charged at 23 cents per minute, which new FCC regulations will require to be cut by more than half. However, more importantly, there are more competitive rates offered by all of the leading telecom providers. For example, in Arizona, video calls cost 3 cents per minute, while Minnesota families pay 40 cents per stamp to send an electronic message. Please note that there are always new compensation models rolling out that could further lower the cost. Should the Department of Corrections provide additional information, we can furnish more precise cost projections and a detailed analysis of FCC implementation requirements. Video calls and electronic messaging are important tools for maintaining family bonds under the strain of incarceration. Most incarcerated individuals are housed over 100 miles from home, making regular visits financially and logistically difficult, especially for children. Video calls help bridge the painful gaps between visits, allowing families to see each other's faces, share school projects, and experience everyday moments that sustain relationships. Similarly, electronic messaging offers a flexible way to stay connected when phone calls are hard to coordinate. Unlike calls, which often do not allow for voicemails, electronic messaging provides a reliable way to share updates, offer emotional support, and help with reentry planning outside of hard-to-schedule real-time communications, ensuring that family ties remain strong despite physical separation. Electronic messaging is also particularly important to a younger generation that is more familiar with digital communications. Family support can change how successful a person is both during and after their incarceration. It increases hope, reduces desperation, and encourages positive behavior, which in turn reduces violence and improves the correctional environment for incarcerated people and the corrections officers alike. This translates into improved reentry outcomes, lower recidivism, and increased public safety. Decreasing barriers to accessing critical communications like video calls and electronic messaging would only bolster the rehabilitative efforts of the Department of Corrections. So in closing, we ask that you vote yes on HF 1861. Thank you for your consideration, and please do not hesitate to reach out if we can provide any additional details. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Do we have anyone else in the public who wants to testify on this bill? Seeing none, members' discussion. Chair Barker.
Thank you, Chair Norr. Thank you, Representative. Could you explain the reason to soften the language from incarcerated to confined person? What's the reason for that? Thank you.
Representative Agbaje.
Chair, Representative Backer, yes. So the idea is to cover people who are both criminally and civilly confined. And so the people who are civilly confined, my understanding is they're in more of a treatment type program. So it's more of a confinement than an incarceration. So I think we wanted to be able to cover that, as well as if there were any other state agencies that were also confining people, but they still had certain rights that maybe people who are criminally incarcerated don't. So we just wanted to make sure it covered all the bases.
Okay. Thank
Chair
you.
Barker.
And then, of course, thank you, Chair Norr. And is there a cost for these videos?
Representative Agbaje.
Yes. So as our testifier stated, there are costs to the videos. I think right now Minnesotans are being charged 23 cents per minute for video calls. But the Federal Communications Commission has put out new guidelines about the caps for a lot of those calls. So I think once that's better understood how that will affect, I think, everyone across the country, Minnesota will probably be able to negotiate for better rates than 23 cents a minute for a video call.
Chair
Thank
Murphy.
You. Thank you. No other questions.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I thank Representative. I just wanted a little help on understanding the fiscal note. The testifier talked about $750,000, but the fiscal note is quite a bit different. So I was just wondering if we can get some help on the understanding the fiscal note.
We'll go
We'll go to
the nonpartisan staff. Mr. Burke.
Mr. Chair, members, the fiscal note in front of you, the numbers that Representative Agbaje referenced were the total, which includes costs at both the Department of Corrections and Department of Human Services. For this committee's purposes, the Department of Human Services costs are $753,000 in 27 and 28. And if you go to page 10 of the fiscal note, you'll see that while there are costs for phone services and the lost commissions that for payment for phone services, the primary cost is for staffing to monitor the calls.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a follow-up question, if I could. What's the total cost of the taxpayer for this program? That's our cost for this committee. What is the total cost for taxpayers?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, the total cost for two more year extension of this would be the $2.6 million in 27 and the $3.4 million in 28 that Representative Agbaje referenced. That's the DHS costs and the corrections costs.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Vice Chairman Gilman. Vice Chairwoman.
Thank you so much, Chair, and thank you, Representative Agbaje. Sorry about that. Okay, so I'm going to go to like Skype at in St. Peter. I know they have the option to Skype loved ones, you know, family members. And when I looked up how much a Skype subscription is, it's $7 a month, and that includes like landlines, mobile devices, things like that. So I'd be curious to see what the staff thinks with the extra cost it would be to have extra staff to monitor people doing video. I know that, you know, I know of a close family friend that's in St. Peter, and they had to have their devices removed because the accessing of the internet was on there and child pornography was accessed, and there was a lot of oversight that needed to happen. But now they have, you know, they still have availability to use the computers, and they sign up, and they can, you know, get a hold of their loved ones that way. So my question is when it talks about electronic messaging, does that mean that they would have access to a device that's in a like a localized space, or would they be able to have an iPad or would they be able to have some device with them that they can message whenever? That's kind of what I'm wondering. Yeah.
Have someone from DCT come up and explain some of their processes. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your response.
Good morning. My name is Nancy Johnston. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Sex Offender Program.
Good morning. My name is Ashley Clifton, and I'm the Director of the Office of Special Investigations for DHS.
To the question and also the process that you use for your electronic communication, please proceed.
Do you want to talk about the Skype question she had?
Yes. So to clarify for the Skype question in regards to the monitoring, the Department of Human Services, we don't monitor the video calls. And I don't know if that answers the question that you specifically had.
Vice Chair.
Okay, thank you so much, Chair. So I'm a little confused because I believe part of the fiscal note was to have staff be able to be there to monitor. And again, not all folks that are confined are sentenced, are there. They all have different reasons for being there. But some, the visual piece of things and having access to seeing their loved ones, or, you know, just depending upon, you know, if there's minors. I mean, some are sentenced where they can't even, you know, be in situations with minors and things like that. From my understanding from House Research, some people may need to have more monitoring based on why they're there. And so I would love to know, like, from the staff's perspective, would this be more burdensome for them to be able to fulfill all their tasks of their day. And again, as things, as people progress through their treatment, some people choose to go through treatment, and their path, they want to, you know, come back and get out of where they're at. And others don't want to participate in treatment. They are there potentially, you know, indefinitely. We've all received those letters and things like that as well. So my question is if you're saying they don't monitor, how does that work with their treatment? So that's kind of where I'm at with it.
Ms. Johnson.
Thank you, Representative Chair Knorr. The monitoring piece has to do with the Office of Special Investigations agents who do monitor phone calls. The videos that you were talking about, we don't monitor those when they're on video with their loved ones and their family and friends. But we do monitor phone calls sporadically. We have funding through 2026 for 4 additional staff. Once the phone calls became free last year, we anticipated more phone calls being made by our clients, and therefore had requested additional funding for additional staff for monitoring calls. And we received that, and that funding ends in 2026, if that answered your question.
Okay. Just my last follow-up is would you be supportive of this, or do you believe that in your current, where you're working and what your day-to-day is, would this be more of a hindrance, or would this be better for your staff and for your work situation?
Ms. Johnson.
Thank you, Chair and Representative. My understanding of the change in the bill was fairly minor, in that I understand that the bill states there would be a report to the Department of Corrections every year on our statistics on calls, which is I'm very supportive of. We have all that information. We certainly can report it to whomever we need to. But yeah, there isn't anything in the bill language that concerned me.
All right. Thanks.
Representative Corrin.
Thank you, Chair. Just sort of building off of Vice Chair Gilman's questions, I think, too, that it's worth pointing out that free doesn't necessarily mean unlimited access. And so, you know, the frequency that people might currently have access to communications, I don't see that as necessarily changing because it's free and sort of having like free reign to access, right? So it's my assumption then that the access, the staffed call times and everything would virtually remain the same. It's just the cost that would be different. And then speaking of costs, Rep. Agbaje, could you clarify who currently pays the fees for communications?
Representative Agbaje.
Chair Knorr, Representative Kern, so right now the fees are falling more directly on either the incarcerated person or their family. They're paying directly for, well, not the phone calls anymore, but for the video calls and the emails, whereas this bill would move that cost to the department or the state.
Representative Kern.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for the clarification. And I just to sort of level set when we're talking about where money's coming from, who's spending it. Taxpayers are currently spending it. It's just concentrated in the pockets of folks who are affected by incarceration or confinement, right? And so I just, you know, I want to make that clarification that regardless, the cost is still the same. Taxpayers are still paying these fees. It's just whether or not we are heavily concentrating that in the pockets of folks who are already going through some really difficult times, or if we all pitch in an extra penny, and in the event that ourselves or our loved ones are in the situation, we're all pitching in for that communication to stay in connection with them as well. So I just sort of wanted to bring that to light, and, you know, just remind us that, you know, folks who are incarcerated or confined are part of our tax-paying, you know, neighbors as well, and that could affect any one of us at any time as taxpayers too. So thank you.
Any response of Representative Agbaje with your closing remarks?
No, Chair. I do believe, though, my other testifier may have just made it, so I don't know if we have time for that. Otherwise, we can submit written testimony at another time. So.
I think we'll accept the written testimony so we can proceed to the other bill.
No, closing comments, just really thank you so much for the time and the really thoughtful questions from everybody today. I think it is really important that we figure out how to make sure that despite whatever crime or hardship you might be going through, a crime you may have committed or a hardship you might be going through, it's still important to be connected to your loved ones. It still helps with reducing recidivism rates. It helps with maintaining that lifeline to a support system so you can do better through your treatment or once you get out. And so I think a bill like this to continue to finish what we started really helps to ensure that all of our families across Minnesota can thrive despite whatever hardship they might be facing. So thank you for your time today.
With that, I renew my motion, House File 1861, be referred to Public Safety, Finance, and Policy. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. You're on your way to public safety. The next bill before us is House File 2143. Representative Amani Hiltzi, please move your bill and introduce it.
Thank you so much, Chair Knorr and Chair Schumacher. I do have an amendment.
So Representative Momanya Hiltzi moves House File 2143 be laid over for possible inclusion, and you have an A through amendment. So members, we have A through amendment before us. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The A2 amendment is adopted to your bill as amended.
Thank you so much, Chair Knorr and Chair Schumacher and honorable members of this committee for the opportunity to present House File 2143, a bill rooted in lived experiences of Minnesotans across this state. This bill is about strengthening our mental health system with compassion, common sense, and equity. It is designed to remove barriers that prevent people, especially those in rural, underserved, and under-resourced communities from accessing the care that they need to stay well. In Section 1 of this bill, it allows the continued use of telephonic care, a critical lifeline for many Minnesotans with mental health illness, particularly in rural areas where broadband is unavailable. While video telehealth and in-person visits are ideal, we cannot ignore the realities that some of our most vulnerable residents don't have smartphones, laptops, or internet access. Audio-only communication ensures that they can maintain consistent and meaningful contact with their providers. And then if you look at Section 2, it expands access to mental health case management in several important ways. First, it lowers the threshold of eligibility by reducing numbers of required hospitalization from 2 to 1 within the past 12 months. Second, it adds PTSD and trauma-related PTSD to a list of qualifying diagnoses. Third, it extends the eligibility period of people who've been civilly committed to from 3 years to 5. And then finally, it recognizes that continued care management can be preventative. Section 3 increases the reimbursement rates for protected transportation, offering a humane, non-police alternative for transporting individuals with mental health crises. And Section 4, it establishes grants for early episode of bipolar disorder program. And then finally, Section 5, it supports the expansion of first episode psychosis program, recognizing how powerful early intervention can be in changing the trajectory of a young person's life. I would like to turn it over to my expert testifier, who will speak further on the critical need and significance of this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota. I want to highlight a couple of items in the bill that won't be covered by other testifiers. Case management is actually a very low-cost service that can really help people with serious mental illnesses stay connected. Right now, people with PTSD do not qualify for case management. We were contacted by several culturally specific providers who said that in years past, they might have diagnosed someone with borderline personality disorder, but truly it's due to historical and other trauma, and so it really should be PTSD. But if they diagnose someone with PTSD, they won't then qualify for case management. I will say that it's not just having the diagnosis of PTSD. You still have to meet all the other criteria, which includes having a real impact on your, you know, day-to-day activities. Also, we wanted to make sure that we look at some other ways, too, to make sure people stay in case management, especially if someone has been committed. Just within the last 3 years often isn't enough. We really need it to be 5 years. And these days, it's not just someone being hospitalized. It can be hard to get hospitalized, right? So why would we say you have to do it twice in a year when once in a year actually would still mean that you might need those that particular service? We also often use residential now, and so if someone's been in residential, we think they should also qualify for case management because they would have had an acute episode. And then finally, what we've heard over and over from folks is that they started getting better, they were in recovery, case management was really helping, and then they're like, well, now you're well, you don't need it anymore, but someone actually might need it to stay well. And again, it's a very low-cost service. We do understand this is a cost to the counties, which is why we amended the bill to take some of the other diagnoses out and just focus on trauma, PTSD, and PTSD. Audio-only telehealth has really helped people with mental illnesses. We've seen lower rates of missing appointments because they can actually just hook up by phone. But a lot of people with mental illnesses, serious mental illnesses, frankly, are living on SSI and not much money per month, and so they don't actually have a smartphone, they don't have a computer, they don't have access to the internet, and so the telephone, when you think about therapy, you're talking, right? So it kind of makes sense to make sure that people stay connected. I also wanted to talk about protected transport, which was added to non-emergency medical transportation many years ago as a way to transport people with dignity and, frankly, at lesser costs than things like EMTs, you know, police, sheriff, things like that. But the rate was set so low that we only have about two or three vehicles in the state, so we want to take care of that. The amendment included residential staff, when they get training on medications, to also learn about tardive dyskinesia. Tardive dyskinesia can't go back. You can't cure it. And so the important part is to catch it early. And tardive dyskinesia comes from being on psychotropic medications. So we want to make sure that everyone's kind of aware of those symptoms so that we can catch people early and make sure it doesn't actually progress and become worse. There are three other programs in the bill, and I know we have testifiers on them, but I just want to mention that two of the programs you're going to hear about, first episode of psychosis and early episode of bipolar disorder, make such a huge difference in people's lives. These are some of the most serious mental illnesses out there. If we can prevent them from becoming disabling, we should. Thank you so much for the opportunity to testify this morning.
Thank you for your testimony. To the next testifier, please come to the testify table, introduce yourself for the record, and proceed with your testimony.
I'll just stay in case there's any questions.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Kate Miley, and I am an adjunct assistant professor in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at the University of Minnesota Medical School, a clinician in our first episode psychosis and early bipolar disorder programs, and a mental health services researcher. I'm here to support this bill, especially sections 4 and 5, which focus on sustaining early psychosis programs and the innovative yet common sense ways we can expand these programs for bipolar disorder. These are services that are crucial for our community and save lives. This bill aims to support coordinated specialty care programs, also called Navigate, in Minnesota. These are comprehensive teams that work together to help young people with psychosis learn how to manage their symptoms, provide support for families, and help people get back to work and school. This is widely recognized as the gold standard in early intervention, and thanks to DHS funding, we currently have 6 such programs across Minnesota. But despite adding new programs, referrals keep rising, and too many people are waiting, or worse, never have the opportunity to receive life-saving care they need. But our state also needs funding for early bipolar disorder. Similar to psychotic disorders, bipolar disorder usually has a young age of onset and results in high rates of disability and suicide. In fact, it's the fourth leading cause of disability in young people and has the highest suicide risk of any psychiatric disorder in youth. Young people with bipolar disorder have similar treatment needs as those with psychosis, yet can take as long as 6 to 7 years to receive proper treatment. They need comprehensive early intervention, but are left without access to critical programs like Navigate. Because of this, our state recently funded a team of experts at the University of Minnesota to develop an early bipolar disorder program that adapts Navigate for bipolar disorder. The need for such programs is great. Other states are already using our model to expand their psychosis services to young people with bipolar disorder. However, while this funding allowed our team to create an innovative program, it only covered its development, not actually implemented. We recently launched a small pilot of this program, and it's already shown its value, but we were only serving a small fraction of those in need, and sustaining it to provide timely access to care remains a significant challenge without proper funding. Please imagine for a moment what it would be like for a loved one and your family to have your lives turned upside down by extreme symptoms of mania, depression, and psychosis. What would you want their care to look like? Your loved one, perhaps they are currently in college or just starting their first job, might be experiencing a sudden change in their mood, sleeping very little, and are confused by messages they are receiving from voices in their head. They need to be hospitalized, losing their job, or spiraling out of school. Meanwhile, your family's world seems to be falling apart as you navigate a fragmented mental health system to help your loved one get back on track while dealing with a new diagnosis and ongoing symptoms, all while trying to keep up at work or school. Our programs meet people at exactly this place, when they and their families have many needs that must be addressed to help them learn about and manage their condition and begin to thrive again. Having a first diagnosis of psychosis or bipolar disorder can be devastating, but it doesn't have to be. Coordinated specialty care programs provide hope and help people truly recover to lead full and meaningful lives. In closing, we know these programs work, and we have the research to back it up. First episode psychosis services have become a cornerstone of Minnesota's mental health infrastructure. We can leverage this infrastructure to deliver bipolar disorder services just the same. Thank you for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you so much for your testimony. The next person we have is President Lawson. Welcome to the committee. Mr. President, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Hello, Chair Knorr, Chair Schumacher, members of the committee. My name is Robert Larson Deuce. I am president of the Lower Sioux Indian Community in the state of Minnesota, testifying in that capacity. Lower Sioux Indian Community in the state of Minnesota, a sovereign and federally recognized tribe, supports House File 2143 as amended. This bill includes a revision to Minnesota Statutes, Section 246.462, Subdivision 20, for broadening the eligibility for targeted case management and community support services to include complex post-traumatic stress disorder. This would include someone who has post-traumatic stress disorder symptoms that significantly interfere with daily functioning related to intergenerational trauma, racial trauma, or unresolved historical grief. The current eligibility for these critical services does not take into consideration impacts of historical trauma, and therefore individuals with PTSD related to such trauma are not eligible. Targeted case managers play an important role to assess and address significant impacts of health of the people they serve, and this legislative change would ensure they have access to this care. Indigenous people have experienced trauma from war, death, stolen land, broken treaties, suppression of their spiritual beliefs, forcible removal of children from their families, from the tribe and the culture, and systematic racism. Federal Indian law and policy during the removal, reservation system, allotment and assimilation and termination eras are documented painful chapters in U.S. history. Indigenous people have also experienced high rates of out-of-home placement in child welfare proceedings as a result of various state practices and federal policy designed to destroy the Indian family's core and connection to their tribe, including their language and culture. It also stems from federal policy on boarding schools. Despite the First Amendment freedom of religion guarantees, indigenous people were targeted for punishment when they practiced their religious beliefs. In 1978, in my lifetime, Congress passed the Indian Child Welfare Act and the American Indian Religious Act. Yet intergenerational trauma, racial trauma, and unresolved historical grief continues to affect many of our people to this day. As recently as 2022, the U.S. Department of Interior acknowledged the intergenerational trauma caused by federal boarding school policies. The community's mental health case managers frequently come across intergenerational trauma, racial trauma, or unresolved historical grief as a basis for patient mental health concerns. Since 2023, 43% of adults seeking mental health services in coordination with our mental health case managers were due to these concerns. Your support of this bill would help mental health targeted case managers support Minnesota's medical assistance population on their path toward healing. The community also supports the revision that accommodates continued case management or community support services for adults so they can maintain their recovery. We urge you to the committee to support House File 2143. Appreciate your time and your work for the people. Penamido, thank you.
Thank you so much, Mr. President. Do we have anyone else who wants to testify on this bill? Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Hi, thank you. Good morning, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jamie Hayes, and I'm the Human Services Director with Le Sueur County. I'm also the Behavioral Health Committee Tri-Chair with MACSA, the Minnesota Association of County Social Services Administrators. I want to thank Representative Mamani Hiltzi for bringing forward this legislation and for taking the time to meet with counties in advance of this hearing to talk about our concerns. First of all, counties share the goals reflected in this legislation to expand mental health case management eligibility. We also support the rate increase for protected transport funding and for early episode disorder grants. We strongly believe in the benefits of case management, particularly for those with severe persistent mental illness, or SPMI. We look forward to working with advocates and Representative Mamami Hiltzi to advance that shared goal. As we do that, I'd like to share some high-level concerns that counties have. Counties perform case management services, although in some cases we do contract for that work. Case management services are not funded by the state. Rather, counties pay the non-federal share for the services. Our concern is that an expansion of case management services would put an additional strain already on a stretched workforce and county property taxes. Additionally, this bill proposes to expand the definition of SPMI, not only in case management, but in other mental health services, including adult mental health initiative services. If the legislature chooses to expand the population served by adult mental health initiatives, we would also encourage you to consider a proportional increase in funding for those services. Thank you for the opportunity to provide some insights on how counties think about these issues. We look forward to working with the bill author and advocates to best understand the scope of the proposed expansion, so that we can properly estimate the impact of our staff and our budgets and have an open conversation to ensure that more Minnesotans have access to the mental health case management services. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for your testimony. Do we have anyone else? Seeing none. Members' discussion. Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much. I love this bill for a variety of reasons, but one of the reasons that I love it is because, and I know you trimmed it down for what would be qualified, but the fact that we limit services when someone is clearly in need of them by a DX code in a file somewhere, when what we're seeing clearly meets all of the other criteria, is something that has frustrated me for decades. Because the truth of the matter is, case management does cost money, but when high quality case management occurs, we can have case managers support people to access medical assistance and keep their paperwork up to date so they don't get kicked off MA, so the county's not paying for holding at jails because somebody didn't take their medication and had an incident and there wasn't any places at the hospital, because that's happening too. Case management costs money, but when we don't have case management, we have people who struggle with mental health issues and severe persistent mental illness, losing their children into the child welfare system where we're paying for foster care and we're paying for family reunification and we're pulling down all of these other funds, but we didn't have case management up front. When we don't have case management up front, which costs money, we have individuals who are cycling in and out of our hospital system many times on and off of medical assistance, needing to utilize a variety of social support systems because we can't keep them housed. When we don't have case management, all of these other things happen. Case management is an investment on the front end that pays massive dividends on the back end when we can ensure that people who have severe and persistent mental health disorders can remain supported, housed, and moving forward to their best lives, including things like employment, including things like long-term treatment, including things like getting better. People with severe and persistent mental illness recover, but they do not recover if we create a system that only allows them to access the supports to recover when they have hit bottom three times in a year or two times in a year, or it's illogical. So thank you for this bill. Thank you to our testifiers, and thank you for the advocates that have worked in this space for so long to say a little bit up front, a lot of dividend on the back end.
Any other member discussion? Vice Chair Kill.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative, and thank you for taking the amendment, adding the amendment onto this. I want to talk about the amendment component around the CPTSD. I want to say Wopinah to President Larson for making the trip, not only from Greater Minnesota, but also not even a week after surgery. I think that is just a testament to his leadership and standing up for the needs of his community and what they're asking. What President Larson was talking about is real and emotional. Just listening to him explain that in real time brings up the emotions that I think he's trying to talk about. The flip side of that is I stepped out this morning to go. Red Lake Nation is here doing drumming and ceremony to start the day, and that's the healing component of it. And so I really would love this committee to consider when a community comes forward and says that this is what we need to heal, that we respect that and we honor that and we know that that's real. And so I just wanna acknowledge that sharing that is hard to do, and sharing that on behalf of our people is honorable. And I'm just really happy to be in this space with you, President Larson, and the work that we're doing for our next generations. We'll be done.
Thank you. To your closing remarks, Representative Mumanya Hilson.
Thank you so much, Chair Noor and Chair Schumacher and the members of this committee and all of the testifiers. Thank you for your thoughtful engagement in House File 2143. This bill is about meeting people where they are with care, with dignity, and with urgency. It reflects the realities of Minnesotans navigating our mental health system and offers practical and people-centered solutions. From expanding access to case management to maintaining audio-only telehealth for those in rural and underserved communities to ensuring that early interventions for serious mental health, House File 2143 is rooted in community voices and is shaped by collaboration. I also want to acknowledge that there are concerns, particularly around the potential impact of counties, and I want to acknowledge that those concerns are part of an ongoing conversation, and my door is always open, and I remain committed to working with all stakeholders to find a pathway forward that both is sustainable and equitable for everyone. At its core, this bill is about keeping people connected to care, to support, to hope, and if done right, it will also save the state in the long run, as Representative Hicks has stated. So with that, Chair, I renew my motion to lay House File 2143 as amended over for possible inclusion in the future omnibus bill. And I also, as I always say, please make sure it's on top of the pile because this is important. Thank you.
Thank you. House File 2143 as amended is laid over. The next bill we have on the calendar is House File 666. Representative Hicks.
This is my first time in this committee this session. Usually it's like 11 times by now.
Representative Hicks, please move your bill and introduce it.
Thank you. I'd like to move my bill for possible inclusion. Play it over.
Possible inclusion omnibus bill, so please proceed.
Thank you so much, chairs and committee. This bill is a bill to give a little breathing room to individuals with disabilities who are on MAPD. For folks that in the room that maybe don't know what MAPD is, Medical Assistance for Employed Persons with Disabilities is a program that's near and dear to my heart. It allows individuals with disabilities to work, save, and contribute to our state. In many times, these individuals also have private insurance through their commercial employer, but the services that they need to remain on the planet are not covered by their commercial insurance. Services like PCA, services like home nursing, services like trach care. The reason that this is important is because many people with disabilities want to work. They want to have jobs. They want to live full lives where employment is a part of their plan. But to do that, they need to ensure they're not going to lose the vital human services, medical needs that are not covered by commercial insurance. So MAPD is a program that Minnesota has that allows them to do that. To be on medical assistance for employed persons with disabilities, you have to be certified disabled. So you have to have proven that you're disabled. And that is done through the same process utilized for Social Security and requires that the person either be certified by Social Security or be certified by the state because they've worked over Social Security income amounts. So what this bill does is it says if a person with who's on MAPD can't make their premium, they don't lose their health care immediately. Currently, in Minnesota policy, we have the option if you lose your job, you can stay on MAPD for 4 months, or you can stay on for 4 months without losing MAPD for a medical crisis, which we would think would be enough. But unfortunately, sometimes things happen that aren't a medical crisis or a loss of a job. Sometimes things happen like a child gets cancer. Sometimes things happen like your car is in an accident and you have to repair that and you miss a premium and you're late on a premium. And what this bill does is it says we're not just going to turn off your premiums. Your premiums would still accrue, you would still be responsible for them. And frankly, we would use the same methods in this bill as we used under parental fees with TEFRA, where we took people's taxes and we used the state collection opportunities that we use in the state, which, to be fair, I don't love. But I do understand that people have to pay their debts. This just allows them to stay alive to pay their debts. I do have one testifier.
You have an A1 amendment?
Oh, yes, I do. That's right.
Representative Hicks moves A1 amendment to put the bill in the shape that the author wants. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? A1 amendment is adopted.
And all the A1 amendment does is ensure that people who are using MAPD can stay on fee-for-service MAPD if they continue working post-65. We have a lot of people with disabilities who are continuing to work post-65, and so this just makes sure they don't have a health care disruption.
With that to your testifier, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good morning, Chair Knorr and committee members. I'm Jillian Nelson, Policy Director for the Autism Society of Minnesota. Many of you know I'm an autistic adult with additional mobility disabilities, and I'm a recipient of medical assistance for employed persons with disabilities. This program changed my life and literally saved my life, and I'm here today to ask you to support House File 666. Paul Wellstone once said, It is the belief that extremes and excess of inequality must be reduced so that each person is free to fully develop his or her full potential. The current structure of MAPD is built on a foundation of excess and extreme inequality, essentially charging an incredibly high tax and heavy administrative burden for the unchosen reality of being disabled. A study by the National Disability Institute in 2020 showed that people with disabilities pay over $17,000 a year more than a person without a disability just to exist. In our community, we call this the disability tax. This is all the things we pay extra for to live an accessible life, like needing a mattress to reduce chronic pain, sensory tools, or the countless other things I pay more for so that they make the world a more accessible place. For me, one of the biggest contributors is my MAEPD premiums. Every month, I pay nearly $600 in medical premiums. Most of the time, it's okay. But sometimes, life causes unexpected things, and then I have to make hard choices. Do I pay my premiums or repair my car? Do I pay my premiums or do I buy new groceries after a power outage? Do I pay my premiums or do I fly to be with my family after my dad passes away? I've made all these choices in the last 12 months. I shouldn't have to make these choices. No one should have to make these choices. And unfortunately, the choice is quite simple. Pay my premiums, because without them, I don't have the support I need to survive. We could relieve this by passing this bill to ensure that people with disabilities who are paying for their Medicaid will not be cut off because of an unexpected life event causing a financial crisis. MAPD participants are currently paying 7.5% of their income at only 150% of the federal poverty guidelines. With cost of living on the increase and the reality that most people with disabilities are underemployed and underpaid, 7.5% of our income every month going to services means that many of us do not have the capacity to save for emergencies or rainy days. But we deserve not to have to choose between disability services and keeping our homes or having groceries. We deserve to be able to make choices in emergencies without the stress of having to file for a hardship exemption and hope that the paperwork is processed before we're kicked off and pray that someone actually approves it. We aren't asking not to pay our premiums. We know that that's not an option at this time. We're just asking for some grace to allow life to happen and to be able to handle unexpected things without losing the services we count on to survive. I thank you for considering the inclusion of House File 666 in the omnibus. We need this protection now more than we ever have before.
Thank you for your testimony. Do we have anyone else in the public who wants to testify on this bill? Well, seeing none, I think this is a good conversation on MAPD. Chair Burton.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. So, Representative Hicks, how does that work? You know, obviously there's non-payment going to on medical assistance. How does the department handle it? Just to keep a ledger of it? Because it could go on, and it could affect that part of the budget. So how would that be handled for losses due to non-payment to that agency?
Representative Hicks.
I love this question, and I tried to hit on it in my opening statement, but I maybe didn't quite get there. So we actually did this for decades in the parental fee space. So we got rid of parental fees for parents of children with disabilities, but for decades we had those as well. And we had a provision that we did not turn off a child's services because of a parental fee lack of payment. And so we've actually done this. The department has a way to do it. They track it, and then they send it to collections, just like if you don't pay your taxes. It's the same way. Or if an elderly person in the nursing home doesn't pay their spend down, it's the same mechanism. And then revenue actually takes your tax refunds.
Chair Buck.
Thank you. What type of grace period are they talking about? Because obviously there will be some grace period. Are they looking at a 3-6 months grace period before they send over collections? What type of experience do you have with that, Representative Hicks?
Representative Hicks.
So I assume I haven't actually asked them, but I assume they'll follow the same process that we did with parental fees when we had parental fees that we did that, and that was a 6 month. You'd get a letter, and then you'd get another letter, and get another letter, and then they'd send you to revenue. And Jerry, very much like how we do if you don't pay your college tuition and the state system sends you to revenue to pull your taxes back, we actually do it in quite a few programs. The state does a lot of collections when people don't pay their bills to the state, whether that be in the MNSCU system or in what was parental fees or MAPD or some of those other opportunities as well.
Chipper.
I'm wondering if there's anybody from the department that could comment on that.
I don't think revenue's here, but I'll get the, I can get the answer for you.
I would, I just the specifics. I mean, I get the general, but just, I'm sorry, Chair. No, thank you. I would like more specifics, if possible, Representative.
Sure.
Chair, you, Representative. We'll get something requested from MMB through the department. So hopefully we can understand how the collections work. I know there are many programs that the agency does collection. Any other member discussion? Representative Cora.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Hicks. Thank you, Ms. Nelson, for your testimony. I just want to touch on one aspect of this. So currently, if somebody's medical assistance, if your MA is terminated for non-payment, what does that look like? You know, you touched on not getting services that you need. Rep Hicks, if you could maybe, or Ms. Nelson, so MA is terminated, which sounds like a technical systems thing, and once you pay, maybe you just have access and things are turned back on. Maybe if you could just try to briefly explain more what it means when MA is terminated for somebody.
Representative Hicks.
So thank you. I won't go into a specific situation. I can let my testifier talk about that if they choose. But what I will tell you is that whenever we turn it off, we have to turn it back on. And in the advocacy space, we used to talk about, like, is there a magic room of switches? There's not. There's a green screen. I don't know if you've all seen the green screen. There's a green screen, and there's a ton of paperwork, and there's a bunch of county staff that have to touch it, and it's a lot of administrative paperwork to turn it on and off. And it's terrifying for people who are waiting to see if it's been turned back on. I wish there was a room of switches, but there isn't.
It can actually even be worse. It can actually even be worse than that. If you're lucky, you wait for it to be turned back on. If the timing hits wrong, like let's say you're due in 4 months for your MnChoice assessment, then you wait until they turn it back on. If you miss your MnChoice assessment date, then you go back into the bottom of the pile waiting for a MnChoice assessment. You get removed from all of your services. Everything expires. You lose your case management, and you have to wait until your MnChoice assessment is redone, reprocessed, which we all know what the backlog is looking at right now. It's not happening in 30 days anymore. Now we're looking at 6 to 9 months. Then after your MnChoice assessment is processed, you wait the 6 to 8 weeks for them to actually give you your results. Then you wait for someone to actually assign you to a case management agency. Then you wait for the case management agency to actually call you, which is another 3 to 4 weeks. Then you wait for them to actually give you your budget or your waiver back. Then you actually start with your support planner again, all the way back at zero. So we could be looking at best case scenario, you don't have services for 2 weeks. Worst case scenario, 18 months.
And I think the other thing. Thank you, Chair. I think the other thing to note in that space is that dependent on the services that that person needs, when that process starts reover, the fastest way to get to the top of the line is to decompensate to the point where you end up hospitalized and you're stuck in the hospital because you can't discharge without services, and so then you cut the line of the MnChoices because you're boarding.
Representative Cora.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for that. I think it's important anytime we're talking about terminating MA, that it's not just you're ineligible as soon as you do this thing, then you get to have all your services back. It is oftentimes a months-long process where not only is the person not receiving services, that includes services that help you through all of these processes and getting through all of these paperwork processes and assessments. You don't have access to that because you've lost it. You lose your your whoever is providing your service, they're not getting paid if you're in a situation where you're receiving services that also include your housing. That bill's not getting paid either, sometimes for months on end. And so, you know, this ripple effect when somebody might not be able to make an MAEPD premium payment is very costly in so many ways that we can't even calculate. And I think this is a really good way to address that issue and make sure that people aren't having to hit, again, we're talking about people having to hit a rock bottom just to get back to where they started. So thank you.
And to just add to that,
Ms. Nelson.
To add to that, it's really hard to keep your job when you face that level of crisis. When you're losing your home, possibly when you don't have the medical services you need to stay alive. And that's when we leave MAEPD and we go to straight MA, which is where you're not getting our premiums, where you're not getting our tax dollars, where we've backstepped everything that we've worked so hard for as people with disabilities to maintain. I would not be able to do my job if I didn't have the support I have in my home. I honestly wouldn't be able to get out of bed if I didn't have the support that my waiver provides me. And the idea of being stuck in my bed for months on end and not being able to do the job that I love so much to be a part of my community because of an unavoidable crisis, that's why we make the hard choices. My dad died this year. And I couldn't go be with my family after. I had to stay home and mourn by myself because I had to pay my premiums. The cost of an airplane ticket was exactly the same amount of money I paid for my premiums that day. So, I mean, these are the choices we make every single day. And no human should have to make those choices. You shouldn't have to choose between being able to exist and stay alive and being able to mourn with your family or buy groceries or keep a roof over your head. And those are truly the choices that we have to make. And we do want to pay our premiums. And I assure you, most of us will continue to pay our premiums because we are proud contributors to our economy and our community. This isn't about building up an entirely long collection sheet with the state. This is about giving us some grace when things happen that are out of our control.
I'm sorry for your loss, Ms. Nelson. So to Representative Hicks, your closing remarks.
Thank you all for hearing this bill. I'm hopeful that we can give a little bit of grace this session.
With that, House File 666, as amended, is laid over. The next bill we have on the agenda is House File 2004, Representative Coran. Please move your bill and introduce it.
Yes, thank you, Chair. I move to lay House File 2004 over for possible inclusion in a future omnibus bill.
And I see you've got A1 amendment.
Yes, the A1 amendment reflects changes to get the bill in a workable shape.
Representative Curran moves A1 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? A1 amendment is now adopted to your bill as amended.
Thank you so much, chairs and members. I will be very brief in my opening remarks. And this House File 2004 is essentially a technical sort of fix. It allows for somebody's budget to cover services when they're traveling out of state. So it's not an additional cost. It's not an addition to anybody's budget for receiving services. This should just allow that if a person were to go out of state on vacation, they can still receive some personal support services. And it does not include the travel expenses. We're not talking about paying for a vacation. It's just paying for the same service they would receive had they been stayed at home. With that, I'll turn it over to our testifier.
Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good morning, Chair Knorr and committee members. My name is Tyler Langenfeld. I live in Hastings, Minnesota, and I am the Senior Director of 245D Services at ACRA, Minnesota's largest home care provider. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today in support of House File 2004. At ACRA, our mission is to improve lives by providing individualized home care services and support to people in their homes. We accomplish this mission by offering a variety of services, including individualized home supports, or IHS, without training and night supervision services under our 245D license. At ACRA, we believe House File 2004 will correct a long overdue oversight and also remove an unnecessary barrier for individuals who choose to receive their direct care services through one of these two services. On the surface, House File 2004 does a very simple thing. DHS has a list of services that are considered direct care staff services, and this bill would place IHS without training and night supervision on that list. The DHS list is important because only support staff working under an official direct care staff service can assist their clients beyond the borders of Minnesota. If your service is not on that list, then you cannot receive that support, and currently almost 1,000 ACRA clients and families are subject to this restriction. I cannot tell you how many times somebody has shared with me how excited and grateful they are to discover the many ways in which these programs are going to completely change how they experience life and explore their communities. Unfortunately, sometimes that same excitement quickly turns to confusion when the reality of this particular restriction is explained. Sure, you can visit your sister who lives 25 miles away from you, but not if 25 miles away for you happens to be Superior, Wisconsin. Support staff can absolutely help you get to your friend's wedding, unless it's to cross the river in Hudson. To be clear, removing this restriction would only bring these two services in line with the rules and regulations regarding temporary travel as other direct care services like PCA and CDCS. Also, just like those services, if someone decided to visit Fargo, the hours they would use would be the same hours they would have used in Moorhead. These are not extra or specially approved hours. Everything comes out of the same already approved state-issued service agreement. House File 2004 understands that direct care is direct care, and if we are going to have a list of direct care staff services, then it needs to be a correct one, especially if not being listed translates into a huge and completely unnecessary obstacles for individuals and families who are just asking for the same level of access to their communities as others who require similar cares. There are countless reasons why an individual might briefly be outside the state of Minnesota, and that ultimately is what House File 2004 is all about. It's about maintaining friendships, seeing families, attending weddings and funerals, scheduling appointments, and yes, maybe even a well-deserved overnight in Wisconsin Dells. House File 2004 will finally correct this oversight, and as a result, ACRA strongly supports it, and thank you again for the opportunity to speak on its behalf.
Thank you for your testimony. Do you have anyone else in the public who wants to testify on this bill? Seeing none, members' discussion. Chair Barker.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Chair. 1.1, 1.11 says provides a waiver participating who is traveling temporary out of state for post-secondary school. So are we talking about for a class? Are we talking about for a year? Are we talking about until they get their five-year degree? That would be my question. I actually signed on to the bill. Okay. So, but my question is, that's so general, in my opinion. So that's my question to the author. Thank you, Representative.
Representative Boyd.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Chair Backer, for the question. I did get an email from DHS this morning that we need to work out some clarifying language on the out-of-state post-secondary part of this bill. So knowing that it's being laid over, and I intended to include this in my wrap-up comments, but there is a question of just some details about what you may or may not qualify for, depending on your residency, if you've established residency in Minnesota, how long you might be out of the state. So currently working on that detail with DHS, and we'll be sure to make sure we iron that out before anything would get passed.
Chair Barker.
Yeah, I mean, that would be great, because like Representative Keeler and I, we're on the border, so we understand going to, especially Representative Keeler going to Fargo, a constituent going to Sisseton, South Dakota, or Watertown for a day. But yeah, we got to clarify that, because we don't want for 5 years for a degree. So I would appreciate that effort. Thank you.
Yeah.
Representative Cora.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you for that. And just, you know, to clarify too, that this would just cover the services for the person. So any sort of housing needs that they would have, that they're out of state in a post-secondary or other sort of living situation, that would have to be arranged outside of their services.
Chair Barker.
No further comments. Thank you.
Vice Chair Keeler, I think someone else was reading your notes. Go ahead.
Right. Thank you, Representative Curran, for the bill. I know you mentioned Moorhead, and in the border city conversation, I did sign on to this bill also because it is the reality that my community lives in. The school conversation, what literally you were reading my notes, was something I wanted to bring up because we do live within proximity to a lot of higher education institutions. On the Minnesota side, we lean into those to build our professionals. And so I know that there is always this proximity piece of higher ed that says, you know, you don't have to live on campus if you live within so many miles. And so would really like some clarification. I trust that you'll follow up with us. But thank you for the bill, because when you do live on a border city or you're part of a border city community, it does kind of stink that sometimes we only have half of the radius to be able to extend what we want to do in our life. And I always love when people stay and vacation in Minnesota, but this does allow the opportunity for them to spread other places. So appreciate your work. Thank you.
To your closing remarks, Representative Cora.
Thank you so much again, chairs and members. This is a really good bill. Doesn't open up any extra funds, just letting people live more flexible lives like the rest of us are able to. Thank you for your consideration.
House file 2004 as amended is laid over. So, members, the next bill we have is House File 1993. Representative Frederick, please move your bill and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move the House File 1993 get laid over possible inclusion in a future committee bill.
And I see you've got an A1 amendment.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would move the A1 amendment. The A1 amendment changes some language in the bill from feedback from the Board of Nursing. So from an RN, it changes it to an APRN or an Advanced Practice Registered Nurse, and also clarifies some of the intention within the bill.
A1 amendment puts the bill in the shape the author wants. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The A1 amendment is adopted. To your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. We know that there's a lot of people in the state of Minnesota that suffer from substance use disorder. And in order to help get access to treatment, they need to take a comprehensive assessment. And right now, in state law, we need an LADC to do the comprehensive assessment, and we don't have enough. And so in order to meet the moment, essentially, this bill is looking to expand who can do that comprehensive assessment so more Minnesotans can receive the care that they need to get. And that's the very brief summary of the bill. And I guess at that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to turn it over to testifiers.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good morning, members. My name is Jinlee Palin. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of Community Mental Health Programs, and I am here to support House File 1993, as well as to provide a little bit of background as to the proposals that you'll find within the bill. So one of the great reasons that we support this bill and have been working on it with Representative Frederick for these past couple of years is we really do believe that there is an opportunity here to increase access to these services, as well as helping our community-based agencies providing mental health services and SUD services to best utilize the staff time of the clinical staff that they have with them in this workforce shortage and crisis. All of our MACMAP members, as well as several of our partners across Greater Minnesota and in the metro area, actively provide integrated care within their clinics and agencies. And that means that they're providing services that really wrap around our clients. They are mental health services. They are integrated with substance use disorder services, that we're really trying to treat all of the needs that our clients have while they're with us without making the client go to different programs and have to navigate the system. We're really trying to do that on their behalf in-house. This includes a lot of new requirements that the state has been moving into over the last several years around the ASAM criteria for substance use disorder treatment, certified community behavioral health clinics, as well as existing traditional services and programs that our community mental health centers have been providing for many decades. All of our agencies employ a very diverse staff, complement to help provide all of these services together. We do employ LADCs. We also employ licensed mental health professionals as well as APRNs. Of the mental health professionals and APRNs, they are licensed to practice independently, and many of them also have within their individual clinical scopes, within their individual licenses, the credentials to provide services in substance use disorder treatment. However, to Representative Frederick's point, they are not allowed to provide that service within a state Medicaid substance use disorder license program under 245G. Normally, their clinical license would allow them to practice and does allow them to practice in any other medical setting to provide these substance use disorder services, except for these very specific Medicaid state license programs. And so we are really hoping to help change that so we can increase access to these services. We believe that this bill, among other things, is a very low-cost, great proposal. We're really hoping that, well, let me back up. We've heard last year as we were moving this proposal that there would be a slight cost because increasing the availability of these services would increase Medicaid utilization. We believe overall that's a good thing because more folks are getting access to care. And we also believe that what we're trying to do here is really address the current backlog and waiting list that we have for folks trying to get into the service. So rather than necessarily creating a lot of extra access, we're trying to keep up with the existing need and the pent-up backlog that we currently have. We've also narrowed the scope of this bill from last year's original proposal, which we think will also bring down some of the costs that had been indicated to us last year. One last piece I might, if I may, just quickly offer around some of the background. Our association, along with partners in Meritap and in March, the two substance use disorder treatment providers associations, have been meeting on this proposal since last year. House File 1993 greatly narrows the scope of our original proposal last year, where we originally were asking to allow our licensed professionals to provide the full array of services in a substance use disorder program, where this year we're really saying, help us have the ability to conduct the comprehensive assessment to at least initiate some of these services. The three of our associations and bill authors are continuing to connect on several details of the proposal, particularly some additional training requirements and the membership and the scope of the study that's proposed in Section 3. Thank you, Representative Frederick, and to our co-authors, and thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee, for hearing this bill. We ask for your support.
Thank you so much for your testimony. The next testifier is via Zoom. We'll please, anyone who's testifying, keep your remarks short because we've got a few minutes left. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Hi, committee members. I am Ashley Chose. I am the executive director of Woodland Centers. We are a CCBHC serving seven rural counties in west central Minnesota. The legislation before you today is the result of over a year of collaboration and compromise across three associations to address the workforce shortages in the SUD treatment sector and ensures that Minnesota statutes really align with the national ASAM standards. There's a little bit of history on this bill. The Minnesota Alliance of Rural Addiction Treatment Programs, or MERITAP, and the Minnesota Association of Community Mental Health Programs, MACMIP, drafted this bill, and then we quickly engaged the Minnesota Association of Resources for Recovery and Chemical Health, or MARCH, and the LADCs for input on this bill. Anticipating this session, leadership from all three organizations collaborated in the fall of 2024 to refine and reach a compromise on the proposal you see before you today. In response to feedback from MARCH's executive committee, the original bill, which allowed licensed mental health professionals to provide the full array of 245G SUD services, was narrowed to solely focus on comprehensive assessments. As Minnesota adopts ASAM 4 criteria, a person-centered model for SUD care, this bill really aligns with its core principles. ASAM 4 does not limit SUD assessments solely to LADCs. Instead, it emphasizes comprehensive, multidimensional evaluations that are conducted by qualified clinicians within their scope of practice, which is exactly what this bill is proposing to do. Imagine how many more Minnesotans we could serve if SUD assessments were available when people needed them, not just when the limited LADC workforce could accommodate them. House File 1993 is a crucial step in making that a reality, and I urge you to support this bill and help ensure that every person seeking SUD treatment in Minnesota has timely access to care. Thank you so much.
Thank you for your testimony. Do we have anyone else who wants to testify on this bill?
Hello. I'm here online as well.
Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Chair Knorr, Chair Schumacher, and other committee members, my name is Sadie Brockmeyer, and I serve on the Board of Directors for the Minnesota Alliance of Rural Addiction Treatment Programs, or MARITAP. We are a statewide organization of rural residential and outpatient substance use disorder programs, and I'm testifying today in support of House File 1993, as it would provide small rural substance use treatment programs flexibility in how we utilize our staff's professional competencies and make a small dent in the workforce shortage issues we experience in greater Minnesota. I'm also a duly licensed therapist and drug and alcohol counselor here in Minnesota as well. By way of context, in recent years, the state of Minnesota has made a concerted effort to better align how we provide substance use disorder treatment services with evolving clinical best practices as outlined by the American Society of Addiction Medicine, or ASAM. This has meant aligning our delivery of services with the ASAM levels of care, including better recognizing the frequency of co-occurring mental health and substance use disorder diagnoses. This has meant expanding the number of mental health clinicians in our program. However, for small programs, these staff are not always being utilized to their fullest, and instead the delivery of services are limited by the number of licensed alcohol and drug counselors we're able to recruit. House File 1993 would allow us to use our mental health staff to do comprehensive assessments like they're licensed to do in other clinical locations. And in doing so, it would free up some time for our drug and alcohol clients to provide direct access to care. One of the things that's a real life situation, last Friday, we do walk-in assessments in my small rural community in Kennebec County or Moore, Minnesota, Recovering Hope Treatment Center. And we had three individuals walk in at the same time to be able to do the substance use assessments, which means three drug and alcohol counselors. And at that time, I did not have three available. And I did have a couple mental health providers that would have been able to step into this role if they would have been allowed to do so. All of them currently working in treatment centers across or in substance use treatment centers and having the access and ability and knowledge to do so within their scope of license. And I had to turn one of the clients away. And so it just really broke my heart to have them have to come back another day to be able to navigate the services that they need. And that's the rural reality of being a rural treatment provider. So I want to thank you again for your time today. And please let me know if you have any questions.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Now, members' discussion. Seeing none, to your closing remarks, Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to keep advocating for SUD services wherever I can, and I hope to have the committee's support. Thank you very much.
Representative Frederick renews that House File 1993 as amended be laid over. The bill is laid over. Members, I'm sure you've been hearing all the great bills, and that means it's a heavy budget and we need a lifeboat. And so with that, I have House File 729. Yep, so I'd like to move House File 729 as amended previously to the General Register. This is a vehicle, secondary vehicle bill. It's not intended for any other purpose, Madam Chair.
Okay, so Chair Knorr moves House File 729 as amended to the General Registry. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed say nay. Oh, I guess, yeah, we're moving House File 729 to the General Registry. Motion approved.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So with that, I would like to turn over to Chair Schumacher for tomorrow's hearings.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have a variety of bills coming through tomorrow, some dealing with group home policy and where they can set up shop. We have a little bit on the PACE program that I'm most excited to hear about, and more as the day goes on, I'm sure will be changing. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher. We'll see you here at 8:15 in the morning. We don't have any other agenda items. We're now adjourned.